guardian.co.uk.
Coupé en rond, là, dans lequel on avait fait deux trous, pour passer une ficelle, et puis...
Brian, just inch down, Becky McGow, well, Ben Madrill as a cow.
Our best guess is that there are around 7,000 languages in the world. That's an undercount, because there are still languages out there that are not known to science. And of that 7,000, at least half of them are endangered. And endangered means that they're not being successfully transmitted to younger generations and will eventually go extinct if that trend is not reversed.
According to the Brussels-based European Bureau for Lesser Used Languages, about 40 million people in Europe speak a language other than the dominant language of the country where they reside. These languages range in strength from the Catalan Pike, with about 7 million speakers, to the Minnow of Saterfriesian, a minority language in Germany spoken by about 2,000 people. In between are more than 60 other language minorities, each finding itself in entirely different circumstances and faced with its own specific predator.
Voche dicir a verdade, podes falar en galego, e a tua identidade, por iso debes facelo.
Guardian Books Podcast with Sarah Crown and first Claire Armitage.
Voche dicir a verdade, podes falar en galego.
Green star and just a simple sort of night sky background. I had a couple of images which I wasn't particularly happy with. One of them was a star with.
The kitchen table in the home of one North London publisher has become something of an international staging post. I joke not. It's where Clive Bootle, owner of the publishing house Francis Bootle, has been busy committing some of Europe's smallest languages to print. Here he is with linguist Paul Gubbins doing a final edit on their anthology of Esperanto literature, Star in the Night Sky.
I'm assuming there's going to be no slippage. Well, yes, you're absolutely right, there isn't. This is not the time to make any amendments. This is corrections only.
Star in the Night Sky is the fifth anthology Bootle has produced so far in a series titled Lesser Known Languages of Europe, already out of volumes in Galician, Norman, Breton and Manx. They're beautifully produced books with texts in the original language and English. But with so few people who still speak these languages, who, I wondered, will read them?
I was working with some people on a Cornish anthology many years ago, and as a result of that, I was offered the manuscript of an anthology in Breton. And at that point, I decided that what the world needed, or the English-speaking world needed, was a complete overview of all the lesser-used languages of Europe. You're right, quite quixotic. And I'm on the fifth, and I've got another five or six, I think, which are coming out next year. And I suppose I shall probably finish the series before I die.
And what are the other languages to come?
Next year is Catalan, Basque, Occitan, Scottish, Gaelic, and Cornish.
All in one year?
Yes. I'm not doing anything else next year. I'm staying in.
So, is this good literature?
Yes, I mean, it's very, very good literature, and I'm amazed myself. It's a sort of a learning curve for me, really. I mean, I do it, obviously, because I think it's a worthwhile project, but also it's given me a fantastic insight into the unexplored areas of European literature and culture. I discovered through the Galician anthology the poetry of Rosalía de Castro, who I think is one of the eminent poets of Europe, who should be really be better known. Not all the literature is great literature, and I try and direct editors to pick up other kinds of literature, journalism, other kinds of writing, just to show the scope that these languages can achieve.
So how do you choose which languages to leave out?
God, that was a bit of a googly, Claire, wasn't it? I'm only interested in European literature. I'm interested in all sorts of literature, but I've narrowed it down to European literature. There was a list which I used at the beginning, provided by the European Bureau for Lesser Used Languages, which was essentially the minority languages, minority regional languages. But I decided fairly early on that I wanted to broaden the series to include those languages which don't have a regional basis, like Esperanto and Yiddish and Ladino and Romani, because they're part of our European culture or heritage, very important, but they don't have a specific regional location. So I'm sort of mopping them up, really, as they come up. And the only criterion, really, is that they have to be European and they have to have a literature.
I'm interested in this, the Manx literature, for example. You know, it's a very tiny place. Does it really have a literature?
It's not a huge canon. And of course, people are writing in it today. I mean, this was a language which was declared extinct in 1974,
Yes, comparatively recently, yes.
With the death of Ned Madrill, who was a native speaker. But there has been a revival, a remarkable renaissance, actually, which is supported by the Manx government. And there is now a school, a nursery school, it teaches in the medium of Manx. And I believe there's now a primary school that teaches in the medium of Manx. But it has historic literature. The carvels of the 18th century, which are sort of religious poems, and quite an ancient ballad called the Traditionary Ballad.
Now, I'm a bit concerned about your fortunes as a publisher. Who is going to buy this book, and how on earth are you going to be able to pay your son's university?
The idea is that the more that the series expands, the more essential it becomes for libraries and other institutions to buy it, because nobody else is doing this. And it is an important overview of the undiscovered culture of Europe. They're very much aimed at the common reader. They're attractively produced. They're not overburdened with kind of academic apparatus. It really is the literature with commentary. Tempero y gesil gilsie, tu gatiar vi pevenal, vizi magi omalmal. 2008 marks the 10th anniversary of the Charter for Regional or Minority Languages, set up by the human rights organisation the Council of Europe to promote and protect such languages throughout its 47 member states. So far, 33 countries have signed, but only 22 of them, including the UK but not France, have gone on to ratify the Charter, which actually brings it into effect. The Council says more ratifications are needed. Tierra mundo irás, tierra mundo irás, tierra mundo irás, tierra mundo. Tierra mundo irás, tierra mundo irás, tierra mundo irás, tierra mundo. Lundo mercredo sabato, mardo jaudo kai dimancho. Esperanto, some would argue, isn't a real language at all, but that hasn't stopped Paul Gubbins from devoting a large part of his adult life to it. He's co-editor of the online Esperanto magazine Mondato, and also edits the biannual House magazine of the Esperanto Association of Britain, based in Staffordshire, where he has a day job teaching at the university.
The number of people I come across who say, oh yes, my grandfather used to speak that, oh yes, my parents learned this at school, but nobody speaks it anymore. People do speak it. Clearly it's a minority language, but it is a flourishing minority language. The internet has been absolutely wonderful for Esperanto. And for anybody who says, well, nobody speaks it, do they? I say, look, just simply go to Google, type in the word Esperanto, and for a language which is supposedly dead and which supposedly nobody speaks, there's a dickens of a lot of life out there. And people are writing, obviously, original literature, original poems. We have literary magazines. And, of course, the great thing about it is, of course, we like to call it the international language because, of course, it is represented right across the world. This is its strength and its weakness. I mean, with a language like Welsh, for example, you can go to North Wales particularly, and you can hear people speaking Welsh, and and you're conscious that Welsh is obviously a living language, which clearly it is. We probably have as many Esperanto speakers as there are Welsh and Breton and a lot of so-called minority languages. We are spread around the world, and therefore you don't notice us. My nearest Esperantist, for example, is about 10 miles away in the next town. So, I mean, he and I get together occasionally over a pint, but, you know, that's the way it is.
Is it an evolving language? You know, does it have a language for the internet, for all these innovations that we're dealing with and that English is constantly having to take on board?
Yes, it's adapting to all these things. I mean, anything which you can say in so-called national language, you can certainly say in Esperanto. There are people, for example, working at the moment, I mean, you mentioned the internet, on computer language and vocabulary and things like that. And I've actually got quite a thick dictionary at home with computer terms. And I notice that is now actually being updated. And there's a body of people who, specialists in that field, who are working on that, who are updating it. We also have texts. I've got a text, for example, on parasites, scientific texts. In this anthology. And again, Esperanto can be used for science.
Tell me how you got into Esperanto. You live in Stafford. You're a journalist and a teacher at the university. How did you get into this?
I taught languages for many years at a university, and I found myself at one stage teaching three beginners groups in German, and I thought it would be rather nice to get my head around another language, to put myself in the position of a learner. So the first book that found me was a Teach Yourself Esperanto book, and I thought, oh, that'll do. I'd actually bought the book some 15, 20 years earlier when I was a student, and my father had seen me learning this with some enthusiasm and said, oh, you don't want to worry about that. He said, nobody speaks it. Again, this old myth, you know, you're wasting your time. And foolishly, I believed him. Now, I so enjoyed it. I mean, being a linguist, I raced through this Teach Yourself book. I thought, this is absolutely wonderful. Here's a language which doesn't have, for example, idiotic gender, such as French, you know, le and la. I mean, why, for example, you know, if you learn French, you have to learn that it's a little girl table, it's La Table. If you learn German, you have to remember it's Der Tisch, it's a little boy table. How absolutely stupid. And here was a language which didn't have gender like that, so you can cut all that rubbish out of it. We don't have things like irregular verbs, for example. I mean, the Americans seem to love the fact that somebody dove into the water. You know, we dived into the water. People in English always get very confused between ring and ring, rang, rung. You know, how many times you hear people say, I rung him yesterday. You know, irregular verbs fox English people. And this, of course, is the language which arrogantly we English say, oh, well, everybody speaks English, everybody must learn English, you know, it's very simple, good grief it isn't. So my heart went out to this wonderful language called Esperanto, which doesn't have irregular verbs. When I'm teaching Esperanto, I'm teaching in many senses a natural language, and it's German or French in a classroom, which is the artificial language. And this is a complete paradox, because people say Esperanto is supposedly the artificial language.
Who do you teach it to? Who learns it?
I've done a lot of teaching at a summer school in Barlaston in Staffordshire, which is now the headquarters of the Esperanto Association. Most people these days come across it online, and in many respects, Esperanto being a regular language is very suitable for online learning. It is taught in one or two schools in Britain now as part of a very important programme called Springboard to Languages, which is being monitored by the University of Manchester. And we are finding that this is having a knock-on effect, particularly for confidence building. And curiously enough, teachers do report to us as well that there's been a confidence boost for learning mathematics as well, that children who perhaps have been struggling with literacy, struggling with numeracy, come across Esperanto, they found something which they can succeed in, and this has actually boosted their confidence in other areas.
So now, will you read us a piece of literature in Esperanto?
It might be nice to hear the words of Zamenhof himself. It's around page 40, our Esperanto anthem, which was one of the very early poems which Zamenhof wrote. We sing this at Esperanto gatherings. This is from 1893, so this is the creator of Esperanto, who wrote several poems, not perhaps outstanding ones, but somebody had to make a start. And this was him saying to the world, look, this language is not just some sort of Mickey Mouse code, you know, you do not have to speak in words of one syllable. You know, it's a perfectly usable, mellifluous language, which can be used for things like poetry. En la mondon venis nova sento, tra la mondo iras fota voco, per flugiloi de facila vento, ne ad vagus regum solato, gila flugiloi de facila vento, Nelloso flugo gira loco, ne agrado sangon soi fanta, gira omante.
partire a famiglio, alla monte eterna militanta, di promessa santa l'armonio.
To the world has come a strange new glory. Through the world a mighty voice is crying. On the wings of every breeze the story, now from place to place is swiftly flying. Not with thirsty sword for blood desiring, it could draw Earth's family together. To a world towards war for high aspiring, it will bring a holy peace forever. Esperantists are saying, use your national language for national purposes, use your regional language for regional purposes, but wouldn't it be more sensible to use an international language for international communication?
So while minority languages continue to face the threat of eradication, there are nevertheless plenty of initiatives by enthusiasts such as Clive Boutle to revive them. Politics also plays a part. The French government is unsympathetic to Breton, but the Irish government has given special status to Gaelic. In Wales, meanwhile, the language has been a major issue in the growth of nationalism over the last 50 years, with mass protests by the Welsh Language Society. The National Eisteddfod, which meets in a different town every year for competitions in the language in poetry, prose and drama, is a major social as well as cultural festival. Now there's to be a new bilingual festival starting today. The Welsh Poet Laureate Gillian Clark is one of the headline guests at the first ever Dinevor Literature Festival, which is being held in the spectacular setting of Dinevor Castle in southwest Wales near Carmarthen. Gillian has written a poem specially for the occasion, celebrating the white cattle of Dinevor Park, whose ancestry dates back to 943 AD.
White cattle of Dinevor, ghosting the valley still 10 centuries since the time of Howelvar. Their dreaming heads sway below the castle and black mountains against the sky. Luminous as white flowers at dusk, 1,000 years of moonlight, their legendary silver lit dark times before power fired the windows of the house. Like Suin, silvering upstream to spawn in Towy and its tributary streams, white fire, electric, veins of history, the cattle innocent of their lineage, how it moves us, brings to mind our story, Rodri Mawr, the Lord Rhys, Howelvar, grazing dusk pastures, pale as the first stars.
The history of Dinevor Castle is intertwined with literature. In the 12th century, it was inhabited by the Welsh ruler Rhys ap Gruffydd, who sponsored court poets and, in 1176, organised a festival of music and poetry in Cardigan, an event that has come to be regarded as the first national Eisteddfod, so it's a very fitting setting.
Well, in a way, I see the whole history of Wales, Cymru, of course, as it is in Welsh, as embodied in the county of Carmarthenshire. And the white cattle of Dinevor, for me, a ghostly and wonderful and living symbol of that history, because they're really beautiful animals. They're not albino, they're white, silver, really, but they've got dark eyes and they're just beautiful creatures. The herd they have today is directly descended from cattle from the 9th century. It's a county of castles, Carmarthenshire, and the great heroes of the early days, or they weren't heroes, they were princes, they were lords of an independent country, or almost independent. Wales was divided into princedoms, and a wonderful man called Howelvar, Howel the Good, 1,000 years ago, codified all the Welsh laws, which are in themselves poetry. And they were laws not of punishment, but of compensation. And one of the originals is about to come up, I think, at Sotheby's for sale, and we must have it in Wales. But it has been translated into English and is really something that all poets, if I give them a copy, they love it. The other thing is that all children in the world ought to know that Carmarthen, the English translation of Carvardin, and Marthin is Merlin, and Merlin was born in the town of Carmarthen. And I think that's an extremely important thing for all parents bringing children to Carmarthenshire to know, because it's a magic thought that the wizard Merlin actually originated in this lovely county. The suin, of course, is the Welsh word for the sea trout.
So you use the Welsh word suin in your poem, but you identify, don't you, as an Anglo-Welsh poet. You write in English. Why is that? Why don't you write in Welsh?
I don't like the word Anglo-Welsh, by the way. My mother and father were both Welsh, from Welsh-speaking families, but my mother thought it was posh to speak English, so she wouldn't speak Welsh to me when I was a child, even though my whole family was Welsh-speaking, therefore giving me the trouble of learning it as an adult. So I speak Welsh, I read Welsh, but my first language, my language of, you know, skill is English, because I was brought up in English, and my mother read stories in English to me, and she taught me Welsh, English nursery rhymes, and therefore my thinking, like R.S. Thomas,
yes,
who could not write poetry, even though he spoke perfect Welsh, he could not write his poetry in Welsh. Poetry, I really believe, needs to be in your first language, your mother tongue.
As the National Poet of Wales, what do you see your role as in terms of championing the Welsh language?
Absolutely. I'd lie down in the road to save it. It's an extraordinarily British treasure. It's the oldest living language in Europe. Mm. When you think that living Greek and classical Greek are not the same language, as Latin and Italian are not the same language, but there's no such thing as a difference in Welsh between what we speak and the ancient language. For example, one of the 6th century poems has a line. I'll just quote one line that's the only one I can remember at the moment. Ar bore dydd Sadwrn, that's Welsh. It's in a great poem going back to the 6th, 7th century. And that means on Saturday morning. And if I was saying to my husband, when should we go shopping? He might say, Ar bore dydd Sadwrn. Exactly the same language. So it's not a dead language. It's a living language.
Well,
and the literature is a European treasure, and it belongs to Britain, and I'm longing to give back to every British child the stories in the Mabinogi. They probably know the Greek myths, but they don't know the Welsh. Let's not say Welsh. They don't know the British myths. And I think these things belong to every single one of us in the islands of Britain. And I'd like people to know that, for instance, the word Dover, the town of Dover, which is way out in the southeast of England, comes from the word Dover, which is the Welsh word for water. And so everywhere, all over the British Isles, is this archaeological, linguistic story.
I'm fascinated by this idea that a Welsh speaker now can read a poem from the 6th century and read it as easily as they could read, you know, a poem written yesterday in Welsh. Do you think that's why Welsh poetry is so central to the country's sense of itself?
I do think so. I think it's a combination of story. Every culture has its early stories. They're kind of prehistory. They're how we thought of ourselves before we wrote things down, but when we told stories down the generations, and poetry. And above all, of course, the early Welsh poets were speaking aloud, singing aloud, so that everybody heard, listened, and remembered and passed that on. And of course, that means poetry because it means rhyme and music. You've got to have music or you can't remember language.
Mm.
I don't mean music like in the tunes of the harp, but I mean rhythms and rhymes within the language itself. And I think those early tunes helped everybody to remember. But I mean, there's no doubt about it. Literature is the Welsh national art. And that's partly because we didn't have the huge money of the Borgias in Italy, so there was never a chance of getting a Sistine Chapel ceiling or the great cathedrals of England. That was never possible because there was never the money. There were never huge sums of money. But the patrons were the princes, and the patrons had a court poet instead of an artist. Though, of course, we're correcting it. These days we have got visual art now. We've got painters and sculptors and all sorts of visual artists today. But in the past, the roots of our looking was inside the poetry. So that's who we are. Mm. We are the poetry.
So we've talked a bit about the poets of the past. Which are the great Welsh language poets who are writing today?
The greatest poet of all time is Dafydd ap Gwilym, because I see him as ranking with Dante and Chaucer, but sort of has the extra magic of being a personal and landscape and love poet, which is very wonderful.
A gwynt. Yr wyberwynt helynt hylaw, agwrdd drwst a gerdda draw, gŵr ereswyd garwy sain, drid byd heb droed heb adain.
The wind, sky wind, unhindered course, mighty commotion passing yonder. You are a harsh-sounding minstrel, world's fool, without foot or wing. It's amazing how wondrously you were sent from the pantry of the sky without any feet, and how swiftly you run now across the hilltop on high.
A dos uwcheiron yn glair deg yn eglir dôn. Nag arod I, nag eiriach, nag ofna, erbwa bach, cyhyddgwyn wenwyn weini, caeth yw'r wlad a'i maeth I mi.
Today, whom who shall I name? I feel that it would be kind of almost wrong to name the poets of today. But let's say that a young man called Rhys ap Iorwerth, who will be reading at Dinevor at the festival, was described by the judges of those who gave him the crown at the Eisteddfod last year as maybe, one of the judges said, he may be the new Dafydd ap Gwilym. And if that's the case, that's really exciting. Of the dead poets, my favourites are T.H. Parry Williams, Waldo Williams. When I was a very little girl in Pembrokeshire, walking up a lane with my father, he said to me, and it only struck me recently how exciting that moment should have been to me then, but is to me now. He said, "Gillian, see this man coming along the road towards us? It's Mr. Williams, the poet." And I now realise that was Waldo Williams. I met him when I was six. And therefore, I've come to his poetry now with more excitement because I know that I actually shook his hand.
Last of all, could you tell us a little bit about the festival and why you're championing it?
Well, it'll be literature and music, but it's a big emphasis on poetry, which is very important because Hay is fantastic, but it doesn't stress poetry. Poetry's there, but it's not the big thing there. Mm. Poetry will be the big thing, I think, in Dinevor. And we're just hoping it'll be quite wonderful for everyone and draw people and celebrate. And I think it'll be fun because there's a lot of modern music as part of the goings-on there. There are a lot of bands and it'll be quite a sound festival, voices and instruments. I'm very excited about the possibility of it turning into something unmissable. I just hope they all want to come and see the beautiful cattle grazing before the great house.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.